Stand Up with Pete Dominic. With Pete Dominic. On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
Oh, wow. Really? We have ads running? Okay. All right. Thank you, at Todd Mandel. We have some weird ads here. I don't hear the ads, so if you hear ads that you're really disturbed by, let me know, and I can do my best. Obviously, I'm not going to do reads for products that I think are real gross, and I don't want to be on a channel, or at least during my program, running ads that I disagree with. So, you know, by all means, let us know what those are. Sorry to derail the beginning of this hour by even reading a tweet out loud of kind of. Anyway.
You're still cool with doing the NAMBLA live read for tomorrow.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The National Man Boy Association.
Yeah, that's fine, right? I mean,
just, yeah. Speaking of which, we have their president joining us right now. Dr. Aaron Carroll is here. Hi, Aaron.
I just want more live reads.
We'll get to, I'm sure we're, maybe we should do a live read right now for your book.
Let's do another one for Veep.
Our guest is an associate professor of pediatrics. He's the director of the Center for Health Policy Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's also the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum: Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health, and the sequel to it, Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. He blogs at The Incidental Economist, which he updates constantly, as well as he's on Twitter. Everybody should be following him on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. He will not be bumped today. He will join us for the entire hour of the conversation. We really would love to hear from you. 866-994-6343. All of your health care questions, health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, you name it, whatever it has to do with Dr. Carroll is great at answering them. He prefers talking to you than me. But I want to talk marriage equality with you a little bit. I want to talk about the science behind it and so on. And also, you were with a man one time sexually, right?
I don't believe so.
Oh, your Wikipedia says that you were.
You know what? That would be awesome, but now I believe you're lying again.
Oh. Do you have a Wikipedia? Look up Aaron.
I have a Wikipedia page.
Let's create one and gay it up if we can.
There you go.
You hear, you know.
That would be awesome. Actually, go for that.
Hey, let's throw Eric Siegel under the bus. He's listening and tweeting. And feel free to call in, Eric. Apparently, he's scared to fly. There's a bit of a rivalry between the two of you to compete for my love and airtime, of course. Are you scared to fly, Aaron Carroll?
Absolutely not.
You're not scared to fly?
No.
He's terrified of flying.
Again, all the statistics would show that that flying is pretty much one of the safest ways to travel, that your chance of being hurt or injured or killed in a car is far greater than in the air.
But you understand the fear, because you may have a long time to know you're dying if you're going down in the plane. And I think that's a fear that is really, really unsettling for many of us.
Well, yeah, again, but okay, Stephen, now.
And a car accident, probably, I bet, I'm sure there's a study of people who died in car accidents and asked them if they knew they were going to die, because it happens so quickly often.
Most of even the very rare traffic or accidents that happen with aircraft, almost all of them occur on takeoff or landing. It is almost unheard of or very, very rare that a plane, like, you know, just crashes mysteriously over the ocean. That does happen, of course, because it's a number greater than zero. But the chances of that are infinitesimal almost. I mean, almost all of the airline accidents happen during takeoff or landing where there wouldn't be, you know, minutes and minutes upon waiting to die. I can't believe we're having this conversation anyway. But regardless, it's just statistics for me. And the chance of dying in an aircraft is far less than dying on the road. In fact, here, this is a good segue. There was a couple of years ago, in fact, maybe it was more than a decade ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with a recommendation that all children under 2 years of age should have their own seat and have to be in a car safety seat while they were in this. And this is a problem because lots of people are only able to afford to fly by putting an infant on their lap. And they figured, you know, really, the chance of an accident is so low, you know, why we can just hold the child in our lap, we could save the very large cost of an airline ticket, and that allowed them to fly. And then the AAP came out with this recommendation based on no science whatsoever that said that all children should have their own seat and should be in a car seat, which means that parents now had to buy someone their airline seat. And some actually people that were mentors of mine wound up doing a cost-effective analysis, and what they showed was that this would force enough people to drive instead of flying that it actually would wind up causing harm, because the number of people or children who are injured or killed in car accidents is so much larger than on planes that by driving a very small but real number of people from planes into cars, they were actually going to cause more kids to get injured and more kids to die, because people are much more likely to die on the road than they are in the air.
See, you always think about statistical outcomes in terms of your own life, in terms of your kids. How do you live your life that way, knowing all that information?
Well, because I don't know. A lot of it brings you a little peace, because you can just sort of understand what risks and what is real and what is not. But, you know, we've talked about this before as well. Everything in life has a harm and a benefit. You know, all choices are you're going to get some gain from it, and you're also going to get some harm from it. And what you really need to think about is how you're going to balance those things. Nothing is an unequivocal good. Nothing is an unequivocal evil. But that's the way that we present things in the media. Cell phones will kill you. You know, they'll give you brain cancer, but we never discuss about the unbelievable awesomeness that most people derive from having a smartphone in their lives. And that, when weighed against the infinitesimal, if even real, chance of a slightly increased risk of brain cancer, it, one far outweighs the other for the vast, vast majority of people in the world. But if we only
but you let your kid
the good or the evil, that's how it goes.
You do terrible things, like a lot of your kids, your son plays football and video games. Those are dangerous.
Well, for two different things. The video games, I would contend that I think that the evidence is not in to say that it's dangerous. In fact, I think there's very little evidence that it's dangerous. But what often happens with things like TV or video games is that they are studied as an association with certain developmental or behavioral outcomes. And it is also, you know, possible that, you know, letting kids watch huge amounts of TV or play huge amounts of video games is associated with bad parenting. And bad parenting, no doubt, leads to terrible outcomes. But there's nothing inherently wrong with a video game or a television set. So if I'm playing a video game with my child in a way that causes a great parent-child relationship, or if I'm playing or watching TV with them and we're enjoying it and having a good, positive experience from that, that likely far outweighs any of the completely negative impact or the completely tiny impact that it might be.
Do you have any scruples about any type of game? Like if there were a game called Kill That Crack Whore, would you still play it for fun?
Of course I wouldn't let them play that. And to be honest with you, you know, when they were little, there were tons of games that they couldn't play. But as they get older, I'm fine with them playing, you know, different games. First of all, I played unbelievably violent video games when I was
a child. They were never violent when we were little. You played Frogger and Donkey Kong, never ran to a zoo and hit a gorilla with a hammer, played in traffic from Frogger.
Okay. You must be much older than me.
I'm not. I'm 3 years younger than you. What are you talking about? What game did we play?
Well, my brother and I used to play Mortal Kombat all the time.
Yeah, well, that was superheroes and stuff, though.
No.
That was like fictional kind of villains.
Your ignorance. Mortal Kombat has nothing to do with
No, these first-person shooter games, we had Duck Hunt.
Oh, those,
they have Medal of Honor.
And I still remember people complaining about Duck Hunt when that first came out.
I was one of them. It's a terrible game. It makes you go out and kill real ducks.
But again, it's like it has to be weighed against, you know, what do you think is really, you know, really what is the damage and what is the harm? And
what about football? Why on earth would you let your son play football?
Because he's still in third grade, and to be honest with you, there's a conversation coming up in the future where we'll probably have to stop him from playing. But at this age, the amount of impact that they seem to be having on each other doesn't seem like it could cause too much harm. And again, here's the thing. He loves it in a way that I never loved anything at that age.
He's going to love and then take it from him?
Well, that's why I'm waiting as long as possible, because he – you know, he bonds and has a team experience that I just never had in third grade. I never cared enough about being on a sports team at that age, but he loves it. He looks forward to it every year, and he really – and he's good at it. And so until I feel like the chance of injury outweighs the benefit that I think that he's getting from it, I will be still inclined to let him do it. At some point, I agree with you. Given the evidence that's out there, the injury problems will be too large, and we'll have to have a conversation with him about – not continuing, but, you know, thankfully we're just not there yet. But if you want to reduce the harm to your children's lives to zero, you'll never let them out of the house. And I guarantee at that point you'll be doing far more harm to them developmentally and emotionally than you would physically with all the things that people panic about every day.
Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us. At Aaron E. Carroll is his Twitter handle. You can ask him anything you want about healthcare or any related issue, of course. 866-994-6343. Give us a call. What is Passover? Did you have a Seder? And if you did you invite any Goyim?
Actually,
any Gentiles?
The answer to both those questions is yes, although it wasn't, neither one was at my house. We went to friends' family's houses, a friend's house for one and a friend's family's house for the other. But I believe that there, at the second one, I know that there were non-Jews. I don't think the first one might have had any.
That make you uncomfortable?
No, it doesn't make me uncomfortable at all.
Mm-hmm. What is Passover?
Well, if I had a problem with non-Jews, how could I be on your show all the time? I have no trouble.
Well, you're helping. You're promoting your career here. I mean, you're a brilliant mind, and you're introducing that brilliant mind to other people.
Maybe. Yes. Well, I hear what you're saying. There's probably secondary gain, but no.
And to be fair, if I had a problem with Jews, I would have no guests.
That's, you know what? There's an amount of truth to that. We ought to do a study one day and actually get the proportion.
Well, I did have two. I don't know if either of them were Jewish, but I did have two Harvard people on the day. Is Mike Grunwald Jewish? I think he is.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he's friends with that Jenny Hutt, and she's only friends with Jews, unfortunately.
Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know if you guys know Jenny. She hosts a show here, but hates anyone who's not Jewish. I'm just saying things to give her content for her radio show. What is Passover and what is a Seder? And then I got to talk to you about healthcare.
Passover is, it's a complex holiday, but it's supposed to commemorate the time when the Jews finally escaped from Egypt, where they had been slaves for hundreds of years. And so it is sort of the time when Moses and Aaron led them from Egypt and under the Pharaoh's realm into the desert for 40 years, and then finally they made it to Israel. So it's the Exodus, and that is it's sort of the
story. Do you buy that 40 years thing?
I don't. I mean, do I believe it was 40 years to the day or that they clocked it like that? I don't know. I do believe that there was a time when the Jewish people were probably slaves in Egypt. I think most people agree that it was probably the time of Ramses II or Ramses II, that they escaped. And they obviously eventually made it to, you know, what is current-day Israel. Do I know that they got lost in the desert for 40 years? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of it is, I'm not sure how literal any of that is. But that's just, you know, my opinion.
What is a Seder?
Seder is the Passover meal where we sort of tell the story all over again, and it's somewhat of a ritual, but it's supposed to be a reminder of, you know, where we came from and how much we have to be thankful for. And it's also a celebration of spring at the same time. You know, Jews merge a lot of that stuff together.
I saw, before we get to healthcare, I want to get your opinion on something. This morning I saw this piece of news that in Indiana, the Indiana Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday that the state's two-year-old school voucher program allowing low- and middle-class income families to use public funds to attend private schools was, in fact, constitutional. In a 5-0 decision, court said that the voucher program did not violate the state's prohibition against using state funds to benefit religious institutions because the primary beneficiaries of vouchers were families who used them. There's more to it. You are an Indiana, is it? You're a Hoosier. You teach at Indiana University.
Yes.
You followed the story. I'm not sure where you are on school vouchers, on charter schools. What do you think?
So peripherally, I follow the story. So, you know, first of all, this is, you know, a state constitutional issue, and I'm not an expert in that area. So I can't tell you whether it's, you know, remember, this is, I think they're discussing the state constitution, not the U.S.
Right.
Constitution. So there's even, you know, we can't start talking about what the U.S. Constitution would say in this because they're not the same. So if you're asking me what I feel about voucher programs, it is one of those things where, you know, ideologically I feel one way, but from an evidence perspective, I'm just not sure what the best answer is. And so I don't know the sort of the full weight of the evidence and the research behind it to know whether it's a positive or a negative thing. From what I gather, in some areas of the country it's been good, in some areas of the country it hasn't been so good. Education is one of those things where, you know, sometimes it feels futile, but there really has been a decent amount of progress. So ideologically, however, I get the idea that if we keep taking money out of the public system and pumping it into the private system, there's less and less money left in the public system, which means that while it's already doing pretty poorly, it's going to continue to get worse because there'll be less money there. But education is one of those things where, you know, it's not even state. It's very locality-based. I live in the suburbs of Indianapolis, and my public schools are phenomenal. My kids all go to public school, and they're thriving. But, you know, certainly there are other areas of the state, a lot of them in more urban areas, where the school systems are not nearly as good. And I think probably if I lived in those areas, I would think hard about sending my kids to private school. So I understand that, you know, people in certain areas of the state are looking for – ways to try to get their kids into better schools. I can't fault them for that. Lord knows I do the same. I just am lucky enough to have the means to be able to move to an area of the country or the area of the state where I can put my children in the public school and they, you know, are really doing well. If I lived in an area where the public schools weren't so great and I didn't have the means to move, I'm sure I'd be all for a voucher.
Why are you answering tweets while we're talking? I just see that somebody tweeted, Aaron Carroll, Pete Dominic, Aaron Carroll's so reasonable, oi. And then you answered her. Aren't you talking to me?
Yes. What, am I not talking to you? Have you heard?
Yeah, you are. But I mean, it's like it seems a little bit disrespectful to be tweeting and answering tweets while you're on the radio.
Well, disrespectful to you perhaps, but I'm here for the listeners and I was responding to them.
At Aaron E. Carroll, if you'd like him to answer your tweet during the show. Amy in Florida, you're on Stand Up.
Hey, so I wanted to talk to Aaron about RAC audits. I'm not sure how much he might know about them.
What the hell's that?
It's Recovery Audit Contractor is what RAC stands for, but it's basically a program with CMS, Recovery Audit, via the government for reimbursements, and I just wanted to how much he knew about it and how much he...
I mean, go ahead, Nat. What specific question would you have about it?
Well, how much impact do you think it's having? Because I feel like, you know, I work for a hospital, of course. I called a couple weeks ago. We talked about quality, and we're struggling with it, and especially with how the program's working and how the appeal rate that we have at my hospital is 98%. But it takes like 2 years to get back that money, and I just don't understand why they set up a program that works in a way that we audit at a 98% rate, or nationally that the audit is 74%. That seems
well. You're
I don't know what she's talking about.
Because this is the way that we.
I don't know what she's talking about.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but are they auditing you, the hospital? Is that the issue, or is that you're
trying
to...
They're auditing claims, such as inpatient claims that they believe maybe should have been outpatient claims,
right.
Saying we treated somebody as an inpatient when we should have treated them as an outpatient, and they take the money, as you know, probably.
Yep.
Inpatient reimbursement is much higher than outpatient reimbursement.
So basically every time, you know, anytime somebody wants to talk about cutting Medicare or Medicaid for that matter, but I believe you're talking about Medicare, you know, they will start screaming about how there's so much waste and fraud and abuse and how we need to reclaim all that money, and they will highlight some story of some individual doctor in a suburb of New York, because that's almost always where it seems to be, or Florida, who is, you know, bilking Medicare out of a couple million dollars, and how this is just indicative of all the waste and fraud and abuse. And then they will highlight numbers that say some very large percent of Medicare is fraud, and, you know, it'll be in the double digits or more. And they will talk about how this is. But what people will neglect to understand or neglect to read or fail to understand is that a lot of what's coded as abuse or fraud was what we would call miscoding. Filling out the forms and billing is incredibly difficult, and they make it harder every year. And so, you know, the number of systems that you document, that you discuss, the amount of time that you prove you spent with a patient, the level of the issue, all of these have to be merged into very complex formulas to determine how much you can get paid. And people make honest mistakes all the time. Now, there are some people that don't, but lots of mistakes are completely honest. And when they go back and they do these audits, you know, they fix them, they figure it out. It turns out there was no, you know, malice intended, and these things get fixed. But it's all billed as abuse and fraud. And so everyone gets and starts building, you know, creating these huge programs to recoup the amount of abuse and fraud that we should get. And so, you know, some hospitals do a very good job. Some hospitals are not. And some people are downright criminals. But the system nationally cannot distinguish between these. So
the governor of the caller state, Amy in Florida, didn't Rick Scott, didn't his company defraud Medicare to the tune of, like, didn't they get fined for like billions of dollars or something like that?
Hundreds of millions, I think it was, if not billions. But yeah, sure. But, you know, that then you get to be governor. If you do a little bit of fraud, you go to jail. If you do a huge amount of fraud, you get to go to, you know, get to be governor. So what happens often is that, you know, hospitals that are doing a good job get caught in the crosshairs because the system, they can't have no good metric to figure out who's you know, illegal or who's just making honest mistakes. They don't even have a good metric to know who's committing fraud in the first place or, you know, who's miscoding. So they have to do things across the board. And some very good hospitals are going to be picked up in the crosshairs. and therefore spend a huge amount of time and a huge amount of expense trying to prove that they're doing a good job while other people are continuing to commit fraud and abuse.
So, it's an important issue I want to discuss with you further, and I thank Amy for bringing it up. If you want to join the conversation, 866-994-6343. Let's go to George, who's in Canada, who's got a question for Dr. Aaron Carroll on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. This is a public service provided to you by Stand Up, bringing on guests like Dr. Carroll, who are brilliant and they're happy to take your questions, even if in their personal life they're scoundrels. Go ahead, George.
Hi, gentlemen. You know, we talked about costs of health care and keeping kids safe and even just us as a society. I just want to know what are your thoughts on, let's say, the dangers and the true cost of genetically modified foods on society, like
GMOs.
GMOs.
We've never talked about them. We talked off the air about how we're going to cover this issue. There's an interesting section in The Week magazine about this. A lot of different opinions on it. I don't think I've talked to you about it, Aaron.
No, but I think that this probably falls in the same sort of realm as organic food for me, where there doesn't. Now, we have to talk about two different things. And so before people get all, start screaming at me on Twitter or anything else, in and of themselves, I don't think there's a lot of evidence that shows that GMOs are significantly dangerous to people, it doesn't have proven harm or side effects, that it doesn't seem to have any kind of long-lasting or negative impact in any way that people, I think, would be concerned about. Having said that, I do not dispute that many of the companies that use them act in a terrible manner or have done so in the past and therefore, are using GMOs in a way that hurt other farmers or hurt crops or hurt the land. That absolutely occurs. And so I think that the problem is that the two things get wrapped up in each other and that people's unhappiness with the companies often gets turned upon the things that they're actually developing. One, I think, can be very dangerous. The other, it's just not proven yet. And as I try to be consistent about this, I try not to take a hard stance one way or the other until there's sort of really proven damage.
Let me put George back on ahead, put you on hold because your phone connection is a little sketchy while Aaron was talking. Go ahead, George.
My only one question that always arises is that if GMOs are safe and that's everybody's people's opinion, why are the biotech companies trying so hard to squash labeling of non-GMO products?
It costs some money.
There's no hidden intent here. They know that there's a significant portion of the public that doesn't like these. They know they get a lot of bad press, and they know that putting that label on them will cost them sales and cost them product. It's just a financial decision for them. It's not that it doesn't have to be that they're hiding, harm to you. It's really very simple. They don't want to lose one sale, period, and they know that allowing that kind of labeling will hurt them. It's the same reason that the non-organic food companies don't want the special organic labels because they know that every sale to something else is one less sale to them. We don't really have to go any further than greed to sort of find a reason why companies might act in this way.
One thing about GMOs that I read is that it makes food more affordable because genetic modification protects soybeans and corn from pests, which reduce their price by up to 10%.
Right.
And that allows hungry populations around the world to grow crops on previously inhospitable land. I'm reading from this piece. I would never use the word inhospitable on my own.
And this is why I say, it's the same way I think about organic food. I understand everybody thinks we should only eat organic, we should push to organic, but if we push to organic, a significant portion of the world goes hungry because it's impossible to feed the world using only organic metrics. And therefore, the good, this is why Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Prize and arguably saved more people than anyone in the history of man with his ability to bring crops to people that did not have them, which was totally against organic farming. Because he, just thought this was incredibly short-sighted, that, this was something that very rich countries were all for, but had no appreciation for the fact that it would be impossible to scale this up to feed everyone. Looking at the idea that, in the past, you have to understand that, 150 years ago, everyone had to farm because that was the only way to get food for the population that we had. We could not have the population we had today without industrial farming. It's the only way that that the vast majority of us get to lead non-agricultural lives, that we get to do tons of other things. Long time ago, everyone had to farm. That was the only way to get food for your family. We don't have to do that today. And things like GMOs are, to some extent, the natural progression of that. It allows, you know, us to develop more and more food, which frees up everybody else to do something else that they might enjoy.
Do you and Amy, your wife, have you ever tried to grow a garden?
We have had a garden. In fact, when we lived in Seattle, we had a garden every year. That was actually my summer thing because I've always liked to do it. We haven't done it here as much. I don't know. Part of it is just our yard is not as set up for it, but I love gardening.
Did you grow in your garden in Seattle?
I was big into Swiss chard, and I always grew peppers, and I tried to grow tomatoes, but I was never very good at it. But I was always sort of into the odd fruits. Like one year I grew watermelons, one year I grew cantaloupe. I used to grow pumpkins, and what else?
That's a gourd.
Did I say it wasn't a gourd?
You said I grow fruits. What is Swiss chard? I didn't even know what that is.
It's like a leafy vegetable that evidently was very easy to grow. So it was one of the first things I did. And I used to turn out a ton of it. You could saute it with garlic and olive oil. It was very good.
Tomorrow, Syracuse University, which I didn't attend, of course, but I grew up rooting for growing up in Syracuse, plays the Indiana University, your school. Do you care about Indiana University sports?
Sure.
Will you be watching the game?
I actually did watch the last Indiana game, and that was a nail-biter.
Would you like to tweet back and forth, trash talk you and I? Should we do that?
I would be thrilled to do that.
Okay.
In fact, I will look forward to it. I won't say that I'm a rabid IU fan. I'm my friends, many of them, of course, went to IU and are huge rabid IU fans. But you enjoy the local pride, and so it's very exciting. You know, we've had a couple wins in the past years. A couple really good showings with Butler the last few years as well. So it's been a lot of good stuff in Indiana.
And you're losing me, Butler. Let me read you this piece also in the New York Times. This is Reuters. Health official acknowledges that costs may rise. President Obama's top healthcare advisor acknowledged on Tuesday that costs could rise in the individual health insurance market, particularly for men and younger people, because of provisions of the landmark 2010 healthcare measure due to take effect next year. HHS Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said definitive data on costs would not be available until later this year. The law eliminates discriminatory market practices that impose higher rates on women and people with medical problems and limits how much insurers can charge older people. But while the changes are expected to lower costs for women, older beneficiaries, and the sick, men and younger, healthier people are likely to see higher rates as insurers try to hedge against continued risks. Anything in there inaccurate?
No, there's nothing in there that's inaccurate, but there's a lot that's left out of that statement. And so if we have a few minutes before the break, I'd unpack it. So first of all, no one should be under the illusion that this is new. We all knew this. Everybody knew this. They argued about this when the law was being passed. This is part of the problem with community ratings, is that the way the insurance market works right now is if you're young and you're perfectly healthy and you want a short-term plan, it's cheap. I mean, if you're a 23-year-old male and you want to go out and buy insurance and you're perfectly healthy, you can get a pretty cheap plan because it doesn't have to cover a lot of things. Sell you a policy that's just directed at you, and it's very easy. The problem, of course, is that you can only get that insurance if you're young and male and incredibly healthy. If you have diabetes, if you have asthma, if you have any illness, if you have a bad family history, you can't get insurance. So the whole idea was then you have guaranteed issue, which means that the insurance companies can't deny you. Let's have community ratings, so they can't charge you more even if you're sick. But, of course, the only way to do that is to charge everybody the same price. And it's not going to be the price of the incredibly healthy 23-year-old male. It's going to be some average price. So, you know, most people will wind up paying less. But someone is going to wind up paying a little bit more. That is just absolutely how it's going to happen. There is no policy which will probably benefit 100% of people. Someone's going to get screwed. And in this case, it is saying that a 23-year-old male who's perfectly healthy is going to shouldn't say 23 because they can still get on their parents' plan. A 28-year-old male is going to be screwed somewhat because they will have to pay more than they would for their health insurance. But there's a couple of caveats there. One, if they make less than 400% of the poverty line, they're going to get subsidies. So their actual out-of-pocket expenses may not go up. It's just the rate of the policy will go up. It only if that single male is making greater than 400% of the poverty line are they going to pay the full weight of the policy. So it's not even that it's all young, healthy men. It's just those who make more than 400% of the poverty line. And again, so it's, we're saying that, hey, only sort of the people that make more and are young and are perfectly healthy are going to get screwed. That number gets even smaller. But you have to remember also that they're paying now for an enormous benefit later. It's like Medicare taxes. You know, I pay Medicare taxes right now and every year. I pay a lot of Medicare taxes. If I don't make it to 65, I'm never going to see that benefit. But I'm paying because hopefully when I get to 65, I'll get a benefit back. And that's what I'm hoping is going to happen. The young people, yeah, they're paying more for their policy right now when they're young and healthy and 28 years old. But someday, if they get sick, they're not going to get screwed. Someday when they get older, their policy is not going to cost more money or significantly more money. If anything else happens in their lives, they're fully protected. They're paying forward for that benefit. They're paying more now to be assured in the future that they don't have to pay more when something inevitably will go wrong, including just getting older. So it's not that they're paying into a vacuum or deriving no good from this. It's going to cost some people more in the future, but likely the true benefit to them over a lifetime will be significantly more than what they're having to pay right now.
If anybody disagrees or any questions about what Dr. Carroll just said, you should give us a call, 866-994-6343. What are your concerns about the Affordable Care Act as it begins to be implemented? We had a really interesting concern that a listener emailed to me that you gave a thorough response to. I want to get to that as well. As also talk about the science about that Dr. Carroll has seen or heard about on gay marriage and what that all means, especially when it comes to kids. Raising kids. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back with Dr. Carroll, who's on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. You can tweet him, but you can also give us a call and join the conversation, 866-994-6343. We will be right back.